This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Ahval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me this morning is Kati Piri. She is a member of the European Parliament, where she is the Vice President for Foreign Affairs for the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats. Thank you for your time today, Kati.
Thank you for the invitation.
So I wanted to ask you a question about the open letter you and your colleagues wrote and released last week related to the case of Selahattin Demirtas, the imprisoned leader of the Turkish opposition group HDP. He's been in prison now on these trumped up charges for several years at this point. And this is not the first time you and other members have spoken about his case. And of course, we have the European Court of Human Rights decision that called for his release, which of course the Erdogan government has not abided by since then. But I want to ask about this letter. How was your letter received so far since it was released?
Well, obviously you won't be surprised by saying that there was no reaction to it by the Turkish government, who of course has also seen it. But I'm sure it was received and also put forward to the foreign ministers of the 27 countries of the European Union, because in the end, it was addressed to them. It was addressed to them. It was addressed to those member states, which are also a member, just like Turkey is, of the Council of Europe, where the Council of Europe's court, the European Court of Human Rights, like you already said in your introduction, its highest chamber, the Grand Chamber, which is the highest possible level of European jurisdiction on human rights issues, has issued a very, very clear verdict. Unfortunately, it took long for this verdict to come, but now it's there. And it says clearly that this was a political process and there are no criminal reasons for keeping Selahattin Demirtas longer in jail. And as Turkey is a member of the Council of Europe, it must abide by the ruling of this highest court. And therefore, we called on all the EU member states, on all their foreign ministers, on all their leaders, when they are coming together early March for a meeting of the Council of Europe, to put this at the top of the agenda and to do everything possible to make sure that Turkey will respect the ruling of the court.
Speaking of that last portion in your letter also, where it called for the European delegations to exert every pressure to get Turkey to abide by this decision, what kind of measures could that include in your view? Would it mean bringing it up in every conversation with high level Turkish officials when they want to come to Brussels or other European capitals? Does it mean rethinking Turkey's candidate status within the EU, which is frozen effectively but still technically there? What do you have in mind? What are some of the options?
Well, I think there are many options which are not being used right now. The first thing to do, which is still lacking, is have it on top of the agenda of any discussion with Turkey. So, for instance, when we saw the Turkish foreign minister visiting Brussels 2 or 3 weeks ago, unfortunately, perhaps behind closed doors, but in public statements, I did not see this being top of the agenda. And that's very regrettable for a European Union, which says to protect human rights, also in terms of its foreign policy, not to stand up for Selahattin Demirtas publicly, I think is the first step to do. So what I'm expecting is to have a united voice by the European Union leaders, foreign ministers, expressing that yes, Turkey must abide by this ruling. That's the first, and it hasn't happened yet. And of course, from there on, you can look at various options on tools that the Council of Europe has, that the European Union has, in order to make sure that Turkey feels also the pain if it does not oblige, you know, if it does not apply the international obligation that it has signed up to, because Turkey is a member of the Council of Europe. It's not a member of the EU, but it is a member of the Council of Europe. And there, of course, we can discuss a variety of options, but it starts with having a clear political statement united by all 27 EU members.
And of course, right now, at least in Turkey's official statements, they have been saying for months, from Erdogan downwards, that they want to, quote unquote, turn the page in relations with Europe. And they've been speaking about this pretty consistently. Most were probably thinking about it in the context of the dispute in the Eastern Mediterranean, or the war of words between it and France throughout the last 2 years. But, you know, at the same time as all of this, we still have, the whole myriad of other human rights issues that are going on for Turkey right now, whether it's Osman Kavala's case, which I know you've spoken up to as well, and so has the court, for that matter. The recent attacks on students at Boğaziçi University, particularly LGBT students, the tightening internet restrictions around social media, that's, of course, not all of the ones that we could probably go into. But do you think that any sort of reset like this, the one that Erdogan and others in the Turkish government might have right now, it shouldn't be pursued without including any real concrete steps on human rights and improving democracy in Turkey?
Well, I think anyone who followed my work as politician for the last 7 years wouldn't be surprised if I say that there will not be any positive reset of the agenda if we don't see actual reforms. And what we hear right now are empty words. As you said, you just listed a couple of things, and there are actually many more problematic issues with the rule of law, with the independence of the media, the independence of the courts. I don't even understand how Ankara thinks it will be able to reset the agenda with the European Union, and let's not forget also with a new administration in the American White House, without actually doing reforms, democratic reforms. There have been so many public statements. We just saw it this week again, coming from Washington on the release of Osman Kavala. I mean, they know what they have to do in order to reset the relations, but I haven't seen any of that yet seriously being examined in Turkey, actually quite to the contrary. So it's clear that Turkey needs its Western partners. It's especially clear that this government, of course, when it comes to investment, when it comes to the economy, is much more reliant on the European Union than to any other country or bloc in the world. And the homework is not that difficult to see. Just read any of the reports that the European Parliament has published over the last years, and Turkey knows what it has to do in order to reset the agenda.
But I've spoken about this next topic with a few analysts here on Turkey Abroad before, and it's this risk that I think is in people's minds when it comes to relations with Turkey, that there will be more of a prioritization sometimes of, you know, the real politic agenda, so to speak, like if they can get concessions on some other area, whether it's in the Eastern Mediterranean or in Syria, etc., that will always take priority over changes on human rights for many countries in the West. Or then, of course, there's the question of whether or not Turkey will just decide to break the refugee deal that it has with Europe if it's displeased by the state of diplomacy between the two of them. So do you think that that's a risk, and that's why maybe some member states in the European Union might be more reticent to push harder on these topics with their Turkish counterparts? Or do you think that these hard power questions, so to speak, or these real politic ones, those will always dominate the agenda too?
Well, I mean, it's clear because, we don't see the harsh statements coming from EU leaders, right? So there must be something. And of course, this is one of the explanations to it. Do I think that's the right choice and the right course? No, absolutely not. I mean, let's not forget, Turkey is a member of NATO. That's also, not just a military alliance. It's also an alliance of values. It's a member of the Council of Europe, the human rights organization we have on this continent. And it's a candidate country of the EU. Yes, we have many problems with this candidacy and with the process ongoing, and it is frozen. But that is how we view Turkey, right? So we are in the same organization, in certain organization, and there is still the candidacy of membership of Turkey. So that's also to which extent we should judge Turkey. And that means we cannot just look at Turkey as if it would be Syria, if it would be Libya, if it would be China, because these countries, we are not together with them in one organization, and it's not a candidate of the European Union. And having, you know, with all that, it really doesn't make sense to only look at geopolitical reasons. And let's be honest, Turkish foreign policy is also dictated because of its internal policy. You can't look at Turkish foreign policy without looking into the internal policy. And if such a big neighbor of the European Union, where we have such violations of human rights, it really touches well the credibility of the European Union. If you think you can just make deals or transactional relationship without speaking out when really many, many red lines are being crossed on what a liberal democracy would have to look like.
And it's almost foreboding in a way, because now that in Turkey, they're speaking about drafting a new constitution with no real specific parts just right away. But, you know, many analysts kind of expect it as a way to further solidify, you know, the ruling government right now. And, you know, they expect more of a clampdown probably on civil liberties and the state of human rights. So, you know, it does, in my mind, just beg the question of like whether the situation is about to get potentially worse before it gets better. And what does that really mean at that point between relations for Turkey and the European Union in particular? Because as you said, foreign policy is one thing, but you know, there will always be that shared interplay between domestic values and domestic politics and the state of liberal democracy across memberships and member states. That's a shared interest. And with Turkey aspiring to be an EU member, of course, you know, they can't expect Europe not to want to see improvement there if they want to, you know, reap the benefits of closeness with Europe or the European Union.
Well, even let's forget Europe. You know, any government that is elected, like the Turkish government, should care about its own population. And what we see now, what we already saw, I mean, why is this concentration of power continuing? Because Erdogan already does not have the power in some of the biggest cities in Turkey. It does not have the power to rule by itself as the AKP. It needs to have a coalition partner because it's losing support among the Turkish public. That is the reality. So, you know, it shouldn't matter what Brussels wants or what Washington is saying. It should matter what your own citizens are saying. And therefore, I think what is happening now with the students in Istanbul, with Bogazici, and which is widely supported, of course, by many students all over the country, that's the signal that the government should take care of. Or how many millions of Kurdish people who live inside Turkey, who elected their own leaders, and then see their democratic vote actually being put into jail. That's the people they should care of. Or you see, you know, the attacks, for instance, on Canan Kaftancioglu, the leader of the CHP in Istanbul, main opposition party. If you see how the government is dealing with her, this is affecting millions of people in Turkey. And I believe any government should care when you are losing such a large support of your own population. I mean, you know, the people inside Turkey are not being targeted by foreign powers. They're being targeted by their own government. And that is, I think, why I don't see how things could get much worse than they are now. If you want to at least protect the right for people to elect their own the representatives. So in the end, Erdogan, and he knows the economy is also a very important question there. The Turkish economy is dependent on the European Union. And Erdogan himself is very much dependent on how the Turkish economy is doing. So to be honest, this is a course on which the Turkish government is at, which I only see heading to a wall. There is no good outcome if this track will be continued. So we now hear the words of reform. Now let's hope we will also see the acts of reform. And otherwise, we also have to think up about our strategy, how to deal with this type of government in Turkey.
Well, it brings to mind a conversation I had with one expert before in my work, and they said that if the electoral scene was curtailed even further in Turkey, it would remove, of course, one of the basic avenues, of course, in a democracy to, you know, check a government that is generally unpopular with its citizens and chart a new course. But they also cautioned that even by removing that, it increases the risk of course, you know, further instability inside of Turkey as well, considering we've reported on just how polarized the country really is based off recent data and surveys created there, and you know, the Erdogan government's penchant for divisive rhetoric and policies, of course, just adds fuel to that fire. Not even to go into the the economic situation, but is that a concern too, that as Turkey grows more authoritarian, it creates another very big unstable country along the European periphery, so to speak? Is that another concern that comes to mind?
Well, of course, it's not in our interest that Turkey becomes a full dictatorship. Obviously not. Like I said, we share many, you know, interests. I think with many people who live inside Turkey, we also share many values. And I think half of the population at least would not like Turkey to go down that path. When it comes to elections, there is one thing which, well, as far as I could see, which is kind of sacred. You know, yes, Turkey, to be honest, has never been like a fully perfectly functioning liberal democracy. But there was always one thing which is very important to Turkish people, and that's the vote, the right to vote, and the right to vote your own representatives. And I cannot imagine that the government would make the wrong judgment that its population doesn't think that that's a sacred right which you cannot touch. Yes, of course, we have seen developments, some bad developments in the past, but in the end, it's still possible by ballot to change your local mayor or to change your government inside Turkey. Now, once you start playing around with that, I think that Erdogan is really playing with fire in his own country. So I don't expect that to happen, which means he will also need to deliver to what his own population wants. And one lesson in democracy is, if you're ruling a country, you're representing the whole population, not just those people who actually voted for your personal party. And I think that's a lesson that Erdogan still has to learn.
You also mentioned that now with the new administration in the United States, that they've returned to the conversation basically on commenting about the state of human rights inside of Turkey as well. How did you react when the State Department, just a few weeks into the new Biden administration, has issued these statements? How did you react with the U.S. re-injecting itself into this situation?
Well, obviously, as a Democrat, I'm happy with that, because that's a voice that we have been missing from the White House for the last 4 years, and not just in relation to Turkey, but in relation to democracy and human rights all around the world. And I think it really makes sense. The US and Turkey have a strong relationship. They are both inside NATO, that if one of your so-called strategic allies is severely violating human rights, that you do speak out. And that was, of course, the voice we were missing from President Trump. Actually, not just missing, he was even fueling, I would say, autocrats around the world, even inside Europe. So I'm happy that sanity has returned to Washington. And I'm sure also that the people in Ankara have noticed this, that the government has noticed this, and are reflecting, because they know they can't get away with the same things as they got away with under President Trump, who had much more a personal business-like approach to Turkey, not based on any values whatsoever. Actually, the same policy we saw him have, of course, inside the United States as well. So times have changed, and that's not a good news for any autocrat or dictator around the world. And I would say it's also not a good news to President Erdogan if he's not willing to change track.
One thing that also interested me was back in December, when there was the last European summit meeting, they agreed to two things. One of them was the global human rights sanctions regime, which, you know, in the context seemed to be almost like a warning shot to Turkey without directly naming it. Of course, you know, we have the situation in Belarus and Russia as well to consider targets for that regime if it's implemented. And then there was a statement.
China. The Uyghurs.
You know, there's a whole list of potential candidates, candidates there. But the other one was, I think it was a statement from Chancellor Merkel, who said that she was waiting for the next NATO meeting to coordinate any potential sanctions options related to Turkey with the United States as the Biden administration settled in. What is your hope for a coordinated U.S. and European action, like when it comes to Turkey? It may not be sanctions necessarily on its own, but what is your hope for, you know, the U.S. and Europe working together when it comes to advocating for Turkish democracy?
Well, obviously, my hope is that we have a joint voice and not sending mixed messages. And that means that human rights needs to be on top of that agenda. And we hear clear statements with that regard coming from Washington. Now, I also hope the EU leaders will be a bit more clear on that, like they have been, and not like they have been in the last council conclusions. Obviously, I mean, you know, I'm not saying we should treat Turkey as the enemy of the European Union. It's not. It's absolutely not. I have always been in favor of closer tie between the people living inside Turkey and the European Union when it comes to visa liberalization, when it comes to trade, to all these issues. But, you know, the moment Europe stops speaking about human rights inside Turkey, that's the moment that Europe gave up on the course of, you know, the direction that the country is heading in. And that's why, actually, I think anyone who wants to have a closer relations between the EU and Turkey must be happy as long as there are voices on human rights inside Europe and addressing these issues. Because, you know, that's because we want to have a closer relationship with many, many people who are having exactly the same values as any other European. So, you know, when it comes to Chancellor Merkel, I think she's a much respected politician. She's not from my political family, but I think she has done many, many good things, like in 2015, what Germany has done under her leadership, taking in more than 1 million Syrian refugees. I think there's no such leader in the EU. But when it comes to Turkey and when it comes to human rights, I think she should have been much more bolder and tougher. And here I'm always concerned about the economic considerations that the CDU and the German government under Angela Merkel is always putting in play, either when dealing with Turkey or when dealing with China. We just saw under her push, the EU has signed an investment agreement with China. We see that despite what is happening to Washington. Yeah, well, we see what is happening with Alexei Navalny in Russia, and Germany continues to build the Nord Stream 2. So this is the point where I really want to see also some more focus on human rights by a German government.
You know, that leads me into my next question, really. And that's how this really all kind of like squares together, of course, because we have Turkey. We were talking about Turkey and the challenge that it poses towards, you know, European soft power and for the European Union in general. But, you know, Turkey's just one such example of that. We, of course, we have the protests that are still taking place in Belarus over the stolen election there, and what to do about Mr. Lukashenko and his anti-democratic leanings, and especially now that he's cozying even closer to, of course, Russia and Vladimir Putin. And Russia is a bit self-explanatory on what's going on with the protests and the imprisonment of Alexei Navalny. There was, of course, a lot of criticism recently of Joseph Borrell when he visited Russia, and they accused him of being weak on criticizing human rights and letting them criticize Europe as a bad partner, so to speak. But what I want to ask you on this question is, are you worried about the EU's ability to really kind of encourage respect for human rights and democracy in its own neighborhood when, you have a circle of these neighbors who openly reject it and still want to do business as usual, like whether it's Nord Stream 2 or some other, or turning the page for economic benefits? What is your take on this?
Of course I'm concerned. And let's be honest, the problems are not just outside of the European Union. We also have two countries inside the EU, Poland and Hungary, which are already integrated as hybrid regimes, not as full-fledged liberal democracies. So, of course, this is a matter of concern. And therefore, I'm very happy with the new president, Joe Biden, as well. But it means that democratic countries have to work much closer together. Unfortunately, over the last 14 years, all around the world, we see a decline of democracy. And if the European Union, which has always been, the beacon of peace, economic prosperity, and the respect for rule of law and democracy, is not able to speak up when these things are happening, then of course that concerns me. Of course, we can't compare Belarus to the situation inside Turkey. There are many, many different aspects on it. But yes, in your own neighborhood, in your own neighbors, when we see these problems, you have to be clear and principled. That doesn't mean that we want to boycott countries or we want to sanction, the whole population of such a country. But it means actually that we have to build relations with democrats in these countries. We have to be supportive of those people who share those same EU values of respect for fundamental rights. And with Turkey, I'm afraid that sometimes we are trying to do, as European leaders are trying to do, such a transactional relationship that they even lose the support of democrats inside that country. And that is, I think, a grave mistake. So we should be supportive of anyone, any citizen in the neighboring countries who are sharing the same values. And we have to be tougher and more outspoken when governments are treating on their own international obligations or violating their own constitutions.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we have both, say, at least in this case, Russia and Turkey, who, they've consistently ignored the European Court's rulings before. Russia's ignored it when it came to Alexei Navalny before. Turkey has ignored it twice when it comes to Mr. Demirtas and Osman Kavala. But how is it though that the European Union can really partner with democrats inside of these countries, considering how quickly they end up being viewed as internal enemies? Russia and Turkey both have new laws that can categorize these kind of individuals as sort of foreign agents, or in Turkey's case, they might just refer to them as terrorists or traitors, etc. What is the best way to really just navigate that kind of very contested, divisive environment, constrained environments in these countries?
Well, it's always difficult, to draw comparisons between countries. I mean, Russia is not in NATO. Turkey is. The Russian economy is not dependent on the European Union. Turkey is. And Turkey is a candidate country wanting to become a member of the European Union. Well, Russia clearly is not. So, there are different starting points. We don't even have to go into history. To be honest, the Russian-Turkish relationship is also not something that is very strong if you look over the history of Turkey or even recently. So when it comes to Turkey, as that is, of course, obviously the topic of our conversation, I really think that we have to use smartly those tools that we have in our hand. And that means, on the one hand, always try to enter into a dialogue, but based on your principles, not based on autocratic principles of the Turkish government, a dialogue based on our principles, where you speak out when human rights are being violated. That is not because of us. That is because you care about those people inside Turkey who are being targeted by the government. I think to them, we should really much more step up our support to civil society. You know, many people always say, you know, do words matter? Yes, words matter. Words matter a lot. Because I'm afraid that many people living in Turkey feel like they're not being supported anymore from abroad, feel like they are forgotten, that their cases are forgotten. And I can't blame them if they look at what EU leaders are saying with their press statements. So, you know, words do matter. That is where it actually starts. I would have always been in favor already years ago of having a much more liberal visa policy for normal citizens, you know, students, people wanting to do business, or anyone wanting to go, for instance, under not corona times, for a city trip to Paris or Amsterdam, not having to have all these visa hassles. So there are tons of tools we can use. And unfortunately, all the EU is right now doing is always very short term, reacting to the situation after Turkey did an action. And I think we should be much more proactive and also use the economic leverage we have on the Turkish government.
Kathy, we're approaching the end of the program, but I would like to ask you if there are any last thoughts you would like to really say on this topic, anything that you would like to share that we might not have covered in relation to, you know, state of human rights in Turkey, and what you think, closing thoughts, what you think the European Union stance should be?
I think we touched upon quite a lot of aspects, and this deterioration inside Turkey has been going on, of course. It's not something of the last couple of months. It's unfortunately something of the last couple of years. And I can imagine that people have the feeling that we have simply forgotten about them. And that is not the case. And that is also why I want to thank you for doing this interview. I'm sure also my colleagues in the European Parliament, we will continue to put human rights on top of the agenda in our relationship with Turkey. And my hope and my wish and my advice to EU leaders would be actually to do the same, and to do that with other allies like the US, because we do have tools in our hands to move the Turkish government into a different reaction. And that's much more a proactive approach than just wait and see what will come out of Ankara. And you know, empty talks about reform will not bring us any way forward. So we also want to see the Turkish government actually doing what it is saying wants to do. And that means, among others, among many, many other things, but the release, as we started, by Osman Kavala, and the release by Selahattin Demirtas from jail would, I think, be a good start to reset this relationship.
Kathy Piri, and thank you very much for taking the time to join me today on Turkey Abroad. And I really do hope that you have an opportunity to rejoin down the line.
Thank you.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.